Hello, and welcome to the Honest Hour podcast. I am Christina Mazurek, your host, and I believe that to be honest is to try to convince someone of your discovered truth of something. Your honesty is your work, your story, your relationships, and your worldview. The Honest Hour podcast is a collective voice of global influences. It is through honest conversations out loud that we can rise together through a more diverse understanding of the world. This is your honesty. Enjoy today's episode. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to The Honest Hour. You'll have to forgive me. I might be a bit rusty today. I am speaking with the first guest that I've had on here for weeks now. Have been caught up in the lockdown storm, and we are sitting in a real storm here today, too, so it's quite fitting. I'm speaking today with a former social worker and now head of student wellness for a private school, Simone Johnston. Please correct me on your name.
Yes, Simone Johnston.
Simone Johnston, welcome to The Honest Hour. I'm so excited to chat with you today. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing very well, thanks, considering the circumstances.
Yes.
It's really great to be here and so good to chat with you. Thank you for inviting me.
No, thank you so much for coming on. It's the first time in a long time I've actually spoken with another fellow podcaster, and there's not many of us in South Africa. So can I start with that and ask you, can you tell us about your podcast, Something to Say, and tell us about maybe what inspired the platform for you?
Yes, absolutely. So I actually only started this podcast a couple of weeks ago. It was at the beginning of lockdown. And I was considering the kinds of things that I would potentially miss during the lockdown period. Of course, then we only thought it would be 21 days. But as the weeks progressed, I realized as a person that values relationships and connection, I knew that I would miss chatting to people, seeing people. My job is I get to interact with many kinds of different people every day. And so I thought about the way that I could kind of get that kind of connection during lockdown. And I'm also a big podcaster in the sense that I love to listen to podcasts. I listen to all kinds of different podcasts, and I have for many years. So I decided to sort of marry the two ideas and start my own one. And so that is when I what my podcast is called, Something to Say. And basically it's just a platform for young South African professionals to be able to share their career stories. I think that people have wonderful careers and all sorts of great things that they're up to. But what I'm most interested in is the narrative and their journey of how they got to where they are now. And I think it's worth sharing. And I think people find connection through hearing other people's stories and relating to their stories. And so that's
absolutely
the idea behind the podcast.
That's amazing. I can relate to so much of what you're saying about listening to podcasts and wanting to feel connected. And I sort of embarked on a very similar approach as you, when lockdown began. I had already had a podcast, but it was very loosey-goosey. I've never had like a regular content plan in place. And then when lockdown happened, that became my stay connected, stay stable and sane lockdown approach. But again, we only thought it was going to be 21 days, and now here we are. I wanted to ask you about your podcast. I know you are the head of student wellness at Cedar House Private School. So you work with young adults, if we can call them that. They're still the youth technically because they're in high school. And then you created a podcast on Something to Say for young professionals. Is this maybe also a gift that you're offering to your young students to show them some inspiration and hope for what their futures may hold as well?
Absolutely. I mean, our young students are always asking us as teachers. We have great relationships with our students at our school, and they're often asking the teachers, Is this something that you knew you always wanted to do? How did you end up in education? Did you know in your grade 11th year when you were, or your grade 10th year when you were choosing subjects, that this is what you wanted to do? And most of the time, the answer is no. The teachers are, you know, share the most incredible stories of how they ended up in education. And I think in that regard, it is a way to inspire our youth, you know, around not always having to know, and the beauty in life taking you on different journeys, and how your story counts for something. There's so much value in your story, not only your end goal, where you end up achieving or being.
Absolutely. And I just remember when I was that age also asking adults as well, like, how did you know you wanted to do this? And when did you figure out you wanted to be that? And when I asked those questions and I heard people's stories, I realized that our stories aren't linear, and that often it's okay to not know, but rather in the listening, we learn what we want. So that's incredible. And I wanted to talk about your work as well. Before you were the head of this department at Cedar House Private School, you were a social worker working with Childline. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And were you working with quite vulnerable communities, children in families that are maybe struggling?
Absolutely. So Childline.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. So Childline works with very vulnerable communities. In fact, the most poverty-stricken communities in our country. And they offer free therapeutic services to children between the ages of 3 and 17 years old. Now, most people are super familiar with Childline, as in the hotline number that you can call, the 0800 number that you can call to report child abuse or to chat to a telecounselor about anything relating to a child issue, or for children themselves to call in and chat to somebody. Now, that is absolutely correct. It's just a very small component of the NGO and the services that they offer. So the space that I worked in specifically was where I offered therapeutic face-to-face counseling with children. Most of these children, if not 80% of the clientele that Childline receives, are children that who have been victims of sexual abuse.
And Dick.
It's a very sensitive space. It's a very difficult space to work in, but also, quite strangely enough, incredibly rewarding. And so these children come to the Childline centers. There's three centers across the Western Cape, and then there's a number of centers across the rest of the country. And they come to Childline for therapy sessions where we work through their trauma and potentially prepare them for court. So some of them have court cases that are pending where their perpetrator has actually been charged and they are required to testify in court. And that is also
the child.
Yes, the children are required.
That's hectic. Yeah.
There are all sorts of procedures that go along with that and different requirements. I mean, depending on the age of the child, sometimes they're testifying inside the courtroom and sometimes they're just testifying in a smaller room with a facilitator and it's on camera. But whether in the courtroom or out of the courtroom, having to tell your story and be questioned about your story and your trauma, it can be an incredibly traumatic thing in itself to have to do. And so it takes weeks of preparation and hard work for that child to be in a space where they're actually comfortable with answering questions and retelling their story. So,
no, absolutely. And is that what you did? Is you helped them work through the experience and understand that nothing is their fault and get them to a place of confidence in speaking about their victimization, essentially?
Absolutely, yes. So we provided therapy, and then even on the court days, we would go with them to court, support them where we could. And it's a very sensitive. The reason why I say it's sensitive is because most times, such a large majority of children who are victims of sexual abuse have been offended by somebody that they actually love and trust. The perpetrators either are somebody that they're incredibly family is dependent on. It could be a family friend or a neighbor, or sometimes it's the breadwinner in their home. And so there are years between, or they've experienced years of abuse before they've actually reached a point where they're able to speak up and speak out, or it's an accident disclosure where somebody has actually walked in on an abuse taking place, or they've accidentally found out about it. And so when these children come to Childline, they're there having experienced years and years of damage and hurt before they actually receive the help that they deserve.
I think that's the scariest thing, is that we want to try and educate ourselves and protect ourselves and our families against this kind of abuse. But when you look at the cases and you look at the statistics and the numbers, it wasn't something that you really saw coming. It was usually someone that was close to the victim, and they were almost groomed in a way. And that's where, I mean, you know, having come from a very dysfunctional childhood and other forms of abuse myself, you see that the mental health aspect and how the person's trauma, they don't even believe their own trauma for so long, because they didn't feel abused at first. They were in a trusting, loving relationship to the point where they thought, oh, like, I guess maybe this is what I'm supposed to do and how I'm supposed to feel. And I can't tell anyone, because this person is not a bad person. They haven't done anything wrong. Is that sort of what you had to overcome in many cases with the people you were helping?
Absolutely. You're 100% correct, especially about grooming. Grooming is such an intricate part of sexual abuse, and children for many years, as you've mentioned, do not even understand that they're being abused. And so a lot of what Childline also does, what I did and quite enjoyed, was we ran prevention and awareness programs in schools where we actually spoke about the real aspects of what does abuse look like, what is appropriate, what is appropriate. I mean, we went down to basics and we were speaking to kids from the ages of 5, 6, 7 years old, teaching them about their bodies, teaching them about what is inappropriate touching, what is what makes you feel comfortable, what shouldn't make you feel comfortable. And all of these sort of tactics that we were using were in hopes that we could educate our children around what abuse actually looks like. Because, as you said, because those years and years in this trusting relationship, believing that what they're doing or what they're experiencing is A, their fault, or it's something that is very normal and happens to everybody else, or they might not know. You know, with sexual abuse, it's very confusing for a teenager. Sometimes they're experiencing things that they're actually enjoying, or they're very confused about what is right and what is wrong. And so
that's like the workplace abuse that we see as well, where it's the line is confusing because sometimes there's situations where the woman was led to believe that it was consensual, but then it wasn't.
Sure.
Because of the power struggle.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you on this topic, for people listening today who from all different types of communities and socioeconomic brackets, what can we look out for signs of abuse in our children's behavior, and from what age and with what approach can we take with our children on how to help them protect themselves from this type of abuse as well? When do we start preparing our child? What do we say? How does that sound? What does it look like?
Sure. I think in my opinion, there's no ages too early on. I think if you are, as a parent, making sure that you are encouraging open and honest conversations with your children, that is the best start. So being able to talk to your children about their bodies firstly. So body safety and body image. So what is appropriate, what is inappropriate, what belongs to you, what they should be protecting. That is very basic stuff that you can start from a very young age, where you are involved with your child. You know, your child is super dependent on you when they're very young. You are the person that probably baths them and looks after them, like,
yeah,
from a point of view. And so my suggestion is to start those conversations from early on when you're doing those activities with your children. And then I think moving up in age, or, you know, as your children grow older, talking to them about relationships. And when I say relationships, about connection with people, friendships, what is appropriate, what is inappropriate, and instilling this channel of communication that says, if something ever feels uncomfortable, or if something doesn't make sense, or if something feels like you're not sure, you don't understand, that you're instilling this line of communication where your children come back to you to ask you about it. Because I think,
yes,
that open communication is often where children that are experiencing sexual abuse don't have anybody to talk to. They don't have a line of communication that they can check, or they can bounce something.
Yeah.
Feel, is this appropriate? Is this not? And then as children move older and can understand more of what abuse looks like, you know, just talking to them about body safety, talking to them about the way they relate to other people, and the way they communicate. Just their sort of connection with other people. And the different types of abuse, whether it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, being open about those kinds of abuse, I think it's very important, so that children feel like they're aware, and they feel
yes
for themselves.
I think you said some really important keywords there. It's awareness and communication, and creating those lines of communication so that our children understand, first of all, how to recognize uncomfortable emotions, and also to be, hopefully, that we've done our job well and we've raised them in an environment where they know how to recognize emotions, and they know how to talk about them and share with them, so that they can take ownership and personal responsibility on how they're engaging in relationships and, you know, things that maybe don't feel right for them. Because I think that's almost where it starts, is in the home, is what kind of environment are we creating for our children? And that is going to breed what ends up happening to them in a way. And I wanted to ask you, you know, you worked as a social worker with Childline in vulnerable communities. So the person that's a victim, once you help them and they get through the trial, how do we as a society and people in your role as a social worker help heal the environment? Because usually the environment is what created the opportunity for those traumas in the first place. Like, they weren't heard. They were abused by their parents. Abuse became the narrative of their lives. And so they couldn't even recognize when it happened from someone they thought they could trust and love. So after the trial, when they go back, have they developed as a person? Have they become whole? You know, this is the essence of the poverty cycle and victimization in communities, generation after generation after generation. Like, but where can we see intrinsic change?
Yeah, absolutely. You're so right. It's such an unfortunate thing where our children are trapped in these cycles of poverty, and they're trapped in cycles of abuse. And I remember when I was, you know, first starting out, a lot of my feeling was around, we're doing such hard work, and these children are doing such hard emotional work when they're with us at Childline, but essentially they're going back to the same hostile situations that they come from. And that used to bother me. That used to, when I was inexperienced, I used to feel, you know, that it feels like it's counteractive. It kind of undoes the hard work that they've done.
Yeah.
But as I've grown in my career, I've realized that it's not about sending them back into that hostile situation. It's about doing the best you can do to empower them on an individual level. And
yes,
I'm not saying that community work and holistic interventions don't work. Absolutely, there's power in that for sure. But I think what I'm very passionate about is that one-on-one instilling of empowerment and doing the harm on an individual level and getting that person to a place where they're able to make better decisions for themselves. And then in turn, being able to affect the people and change in their nuclear family. And so,
yes, it's like a ripple effect.
Exactly. And so along with the work that I did at Childline, we focused a lot on self-esteem, building confidence, building or instilling empowerment in that client so that they're able to make better decisions for themselves. And not only make better decisions, but know and believe that they deserve better opportunity. So they seek out better opportunity. They seek out resources that could potentially help them. And that's where society gets involved. So NGOs that are, and not only NGOs, but all kinds of institutions, organizations that are offering scholarships and bursaries and being able to put finance behind opportunity so that there is access to people that cannot, that aren't able to access those opportunities. So I think from a societal point of view, for us to be able to put initiatives and programs together that hold and give a platform to those people that are now feeling empowered, feeling like they can overcome whatever circumstance they're living in, because the truth is they may never get out of that circumstance. They may never ever get out of that a cycle of poverty. But to be able to do better for themselves and feel empowered and feel like they can chase a dream that they deserve, I think is important to start with the individual.
Absolutely, and I have this thought in my head about one little life draft at a time. And, you know, if I look back on my own upbringing and like the very dysfunctional childhood I came from, with the abuse to the point where my parents gave me away for adoption when I was 10 years old, I was dropped off at a foster home and I never saw my dad again. I mean, it was so severe that that had to happen, but I survived and I almost had like one little life raft at a time from each dysfunctional circumstance, like not being taken to school or being left in a hotel room by my parents and not knowing where anyone was, and then having a social worker come and going to a foster home and then having a new family. And I would like to think that I'm in a really stable, healthy position within myself today. But it wasn't one thing that changed it. It was built within myself, one fiber, one thought at a time. And it was from one little helping hand at a time. And that's what helped me change my environment too. And, you know, I love to quote Mother Teresa. She says so many wise things that it can apply to a person of any faith. And one thing that she says is, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family. And to me, it what that means is that if you want to change the world, if you see that there's a systemic problem, if you recognize racism, oppression, war on women, all of the narratives that we're discussing today, look around you within your own little vicinity. What's happening in your domestic workers' lives? Mm-hmm. What's happening in your children's lives? What's happening in the lives of the children that have playdates with your children? Where can you help someone feel loved and empowered today? And that small change breeds a wave of growth in communities because you're lifting one person up at a time, truly. But that's what you said in your job, is that you love the individual one-on-one work. You love helping that person become empowered and to rise above their circumstances, and they can lift others as they rise. And for those who don't know how to help others, you know, we can donate, we can support the NGOs and the charities that are creating this pond from which they can pull resources from. But really, it starts with one person to person at a time.
Absolutely. And, you know, I love what you said about that starting at home, because a lot of the good work that is done in the world all stems from relationship. And we often think out relationship or connections that we can make to help others, yet we're sitting with a pool of relationships around us, the people that are closest to us. And so much work comes from personal connection and personal relationship. And so you're right, looking at those relationships that surround us and that we have established already, and how we can make those relationships better and how we can make those people better.
Absolutely. And we even see in developed countries, if you look at America, my home country, they have so many societal problems now that are not similar at all to what we see in our African communities. But I mean, they have the highest opiate use in the world.
Yeah.
Children are medicated from such a young age. We are seeing mass school shootings from children that were raised in otherwise healthy, stable families. I mean, these are not adults that had a childhood where they were raped or abused. You know what it was? It was, there was disconnection. Oh, and they're almost the loneliest society.
Yeah, there was lack of relationship.
So I think we need to be really aware of how powerful our words and our voices and our behavior impacts our relationship with our children, and how the lack or control of use of our relationship with our children is going to impact how they behave in the world. So that's what I believe Mother Teresa means when she says, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family truly. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Simone. Sorry about that. Looks like something happened with my internet connection and we were on such a roll. So I'm sorry if you were chatting for a while there and we didn't get to record any of it. But I want to continue this amazing conversation. I think we left off with just reiterating that the real change starts in the relationships you have right now. That's where we make real positive waves of change in the world.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's why I really respect and love the work that you're doing with individuals who have been victims of abuse in intrinsically traumatic communities that we're going to see struggle for a few generations to come, at least. How long were you a social worker, and when did you transition to becoming the head of student wellness at Cedar House Private School?
So I've been a social worker since I graduated in 2011. I spent a year overseas, actually in your home country. I lived in the States.
Sorry. Oh,
and
which state were you in?
I lived
I'm
in
just curious.
Washington, D.C.
Oh, amazing.
I was an au pair with a lovely American family with two gorgeous children. And that was a fantastic experience. But being a social worker really called me home. And so I started practicing in 2013. I worked for an organization that worked with geriatric clients in 2013. And then I was with Childline from 2014 to the end of 2017. So I joined Cedar House in 2018. So yeah, I did.
Oh, wow.
About 3 and a bit years with Childline.
Amazing. Yeah, that's a long time. You would have definitely had a real window into what's happening in our communities and with our children. And now you're working with the older kids and helping them get ready and get confidence and into the world. I wanted to ask you now, how are your students managing in this crazy time that we're in? It's a difficult time in one's life in a normal circumstance. I don't even know what normal is anymore. But, you know, we are now in a global pandemic, and South Africa, where we are now, we living, for anyone listening, we're both living in South Africa. We've had one of the most strict responses in terms of our lockdown. And it's really impacted, gosh, the economy, communities, but also our students. The education system has been shook. How are your students doing mentally in all of this? What kind of conversations are you having with them?
Absolutely. So I think what we have to remember is adolescence, the phase of adolescence already is this very confusing, challenging time that teens are having to navigate just in normal circumstances. In fact, I always joke with my teenage students, my clients, that I would never want to go back and be an adolescent because actually it is a difficult time of life.
I agree with you.
And I always tell them, you're so brave and you're so courageous to be navigating this stuff because I know it is incredibly difficult. And so if we look at theory, we can see that the adolescent phase is a phase where they are navigating a psychosocial crisis called identity versus role confusion. And so it's all about who am I and where do I belong and how do I fit into society? What is my role in society?
Oh my gosh. I thought that was only me. So that's a thing that everyone experiences. What's it called again? A psychosocial crisis with a role and so identity.
So the specific crisis that adolescents are experiencing in this time is called identity versus role confusion. And so if you look at identity and what goes with that, there's a million things that they're trying to navigate and figure out within themselves. Who am I? What is my purpose? What am I experiencing? What does this mental health feel like? What does my body image feel like? What am I doing with my time? Who am I relating to? And then you look at role confusion, like who do I belong to? What group do I belong to? Do I belong to? And so that is what they're experiencing just within normal circumstances. Now we throw an entire global pandemic into the mix. And there's just so much going on. There's so much that they're having to navigate and cope with. And it's also incredibly culturally and environmentally dependent. So if you look at across our country, it looks so different for so many different adolescents. The school that I work at is specifically a community of people that are privileged to have the resources for us to have continued our academic program online. During lockdown, they've had the privilege of being able to access their teachers, their classes, their content online. They've had the resources to do that. Now, I always keep in mind that not everybody is in that position. And so if you think about the teenagers, even I think specifically about matric students in the most important year of their career, their school career, that haven't been able to access the content, the pressure and anxiety of having to go back to school now and get through that content is insane. That must be so anxiety-provoking. And their time management and organizational skills are just thrown in the mix and you're just having to cope with getting up to speed. And so,
yeah, and the impact it'll have on the family, because the parents obviously then take on the responsibility without having the tools or resources or education on how to be teachers to help their children. And it's stressful.
Absolutely.
Puts a lot of pressure on the relationship.
Absolutely. And with the nature of lockdown, everybody is at home. And so children who are, living in poverty-stricken communities where everybody lives in the same room or is in the same household all the time, can you imagine what it must feel like to come home and have to work through this content and be working extra hard and be extra requires extra concentration from you, but you're living in a household where there's 5, 6, 7 people who are all in your space and taking up your time.
So
in our specific school, if I could just speak to, I'm not sure if you wanted me to speak to like what actually school looks like now that we're back at school.
Yes. Let's talk about what school looks like and then especially the mental health of the students as it pertains to the effects of this pandemic on their lives.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of anxiety around, well, there was a lot of anxiety around what would school look like? How would it work? And so we have families who are comfortable with the online program because they have control and they have the opportunity to make sure that their child is safe and healthy. And now sending their kids back to school was quite a big step. It was a big step to release your students. I mean, I'm sure your boys have gone back to school this week. And, you know, that step of saying, okay, right, I'm releasing you out. We've all been, I said to our students, it feels like we've all been hibernating for months. And now we're having to step out of our shells into the big world again. And that is huge. And so what we did is we began the entire process with what we called orientation sessions. And so we spent a good amount of time orientating both our staff and our students to come back to school. And so
that's so nurturing. That's amazing.
We spoke through physical changes, so what they will see, to procedures that they'll have to partake in when they arrive at school, to how this will affect them on a mental health level. We address things like stigma, watching the kinds of conversations that we have, and then also encouraging them to communicate and express their feelings, because what they're experiencing is very normal. All the feelings that they're experiencing is very normal, but in a very abnormal situation.
Yeah.
And so just checking those responses and making sure that they feel comfortable with responding and that they do check their own response. So they're aware of how they feel. They're aware of their response. And
they expect it. Gives them that confidence. Like, okay, this is what we were told was going to happen. Okay, this is normal. I'll get through this.
Exactly. And then basics around like safety protocols. So what to do if they're experiencing a symptom during the day, who to contact, what is the procedure? How do I make sure that I'm safe, keeping myself safe, but also keeping others safe around me? So school looks incredibly different just from a physical point of view. There are signs and markings up all over the premises. There are arrows on the floor to show you which way to walk. There are social distancing codes all over. The desks have been and chairs have been measured 1.5 meters from each other. Kids have to wear masks for the entire day. They're screened at the gate every single morning. They have their temperatures taken and they're asked a number of questions related to COVID-19 symptoms. They're not at school.
It's so scary.
All of their friends. Some friends are at home. So it's this time of I've been away from my social interactions, you know, face to face for the last how many weeks, but there's no guarantee that all my friends will actually be at school because we're all navigating this this time differently. Different families are responding differently.
Absolutely.
So you can just hear, even me trying to describe it, there's so many emotions and dynamics at play. And that in itself is anxiety provoking for the people running the procedures, for the people receiving the procedures, for our staff component, for our students. I think the levels of anxiety were incredibly high at the beginning of our the term, once we had gone back face to face. I think that level of expectation, but also balancing the I'm not too sure of what to expect. So the uncertainty of the space that I'm going into. And then there was a lot of excitement and connection around, yes, I get to see my friends again. I get to, as I've mentioned before, at our school, we have very close relationships with our students. So students were very excited to see teachers again, to be in classroom spaces. They really enjoy our classroom spaces. And managing, you know, uncertainty, anxiety, but excitement. And I'm here. And
absolutely.
And we're engaging again. And then time management, now having to re-manage my time. Their time had to be managed in a whole different light, being in lockdown, versus to your school routine. So there's a lot going on.
No, jeepers. I think like another layer of privilege I can recognize for your students, and it's so amazing that they have this is that they have you. You know, they have a social worker, they have someone with the understandings of psychology and change management and adapting to uncertain times to help them breed this culture of resilience. This is their first opportunity for many of them to develop that amazing skill that they're going to need to navigate the world they're about to enter. I mean, and even if it was just a normal world, like you said, we have that whole psychosocial role versus identity situation. And now they're sitting here like, okay, our whole life and routine and school and family and friendship circles and environments have been turned upside down. And you know, this is why I think they're so, it's so amazing that they have you, because when I realized my children were returning to school, it was a wave. It was like a cluster of emotions that contradicted each other at every turn. In one breath, I was excited that they're going to have some normalcy in their lives again, and that I'm going to have some time back to myself to do these little passion projects of mine.
Sure.
And then I was nervous because I don't know what to expect. How will my children react? And then I had this huge block against them learning from, like, they're learning phonetics and numericals, and they're still learning by reading lips and facial expressions to identify emotions and how we interact with each other and self-regulating and personal boundaries and just making words, the most basics of education. And how can they get that through a teacher that cannot come and put their hand on their arm or comfort them if they're sad or make a smiley face or a concerned face or teach them how the letter T sounds and what your mouth looks like when you're making it? And then I thought, okay, you know what? If we're going to do this, I need to be able to be strong enough to be my children's coach, because this is their emotional experience and I have to be the adult in the room. So I took like a morning off and I read all the stuff that the school sent us, and they were amazing. Just like yours, they made this amazing video to prepare us emotionally and mentally for what the school has set up, why we're doing it. They made a video for the parents to watch, a video for the students to watch, and they made it exciting. Like, here's the footsteps that mark the distance. This is Dinosaur Daisy and Dinosaur Danny. I don't know, I was blown away, and it empowered me to be that rock that my children need so that I know what they're going to experience emotionally and mentally before they experience it, so I can help them overcome it and regulate themselves healthily. I didn't have that growing up, and a lot of our communities in South Africa now, most of the schools don't have that luxury as well. So it's amazing that they have you and how it's been handled. And I do think that we can see the silver lining here, that they're going to develop those tools for resilience early on.
Absolutely. And another tool that I've seen that they are developing is empathy. It's such a, such a critical space to be using empathy on all kinds of levels. And just recognizing that everybody is responding to this pandemic, but we're responding differently, and recognizing and acknowledging that your feeling or response may be different to mine, but there's some, I can relate to you on some level, but on another level, I can just support you. And I think our students they've been given the perfect opportunity to practice empathy during this time.
Yeah, that empathy and compassion helps us get away from the polarized culture that we're living in now, where there's such a dichotomy of views and responses to things politically. There's such a polarized atmosphere in the world. And it's nice to hear that for the younger generation, they're getting those opportunities to learn respect through compassion and support.
Yes, absolutely.
Because not everyone will respond to this pandemic the same, because they have different circumstances. Some people have vulnerable family members because of health conditions. Some people don't have the means. They've lost jobs. They can't go back to school. You know, but whatever it may be, I think it breeds that emotion within them to be able to say, you're responding to life differently. I don't understand, because I'm not you. You are you. But I can still love you and support you without taking away from me.
Absolutely.
It's healthy.
Yes.
But do you know what else our children are experiencing today, whether they're in a privileged community or a vulnerable community in this pandemic? It's different from you and I in our childhoods and growing up, not just because of a pandemic, but they are living in the age of social media and building for themselves digital footprints. I am still learning how to navigate, how to look at how relationships happen on the internet versus how relationships happen in real life and how people are sharing highlights versus not the whole story. Now, I've gone through that whole role versus identity, psychosocial crisis that you talked about. I am a grown adult and I still have days where I feel really low because of how I'm interpreting social media. Now, how has this impacted our youth? Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the difference today is that our teens and adolescents are experiencing a number of these crises offline and online. So they're actually navigating both worlds simultaneously. And that can be incredibly anxiety provoking and cause all sorts of mental illness or exacerbate a mental illness that they're experiencing. But with social media specifically, what I've seen is a lot of teens rely on social media to build their self-esteem. And they're looking for acceptance through the world of social media. And that can be as simple as, how many likes do I have on my post? How many people are following me on Instagram? How many people have engaged with my Instagram story? And that acceptance of, am I likable? Am I relatable? And it's not so much about the content that they're producing, more about finding that validation just from simple connection online. And that can be dangerous and very...
They also compare.
Exactly. And that leads me to my next point, is that it leads to huge comparison, comparing their lives. And like you say, people often just show highlights or show curated spaces of what they want you to see and not what the what reality looks like. And so they're making comparisons with potentially fake representations of people's real situations. And that can be incredibly damaging to their self-esteem. And it can, and to the point where it can suck teens into low, very dark holes that lead to depression. And so this virtual world...
And we've seen a rise in suicide as well.
Absolutely. And so this virtual world that they're living in is just this demanding world, this world that they're constantly having to keep up with. Am I in the right places? Have I posted on Instagram about where I am and what I'm doing? You know, am I socializing with the right people? There's so many demands that social media makes of them that causes them to be... like sucked up by it consumed by it. And then if you look at the risk of social media around cyberbullying and the platform that social media gives. So yes, and don't get me wrong, there are so many skills and techniques and benefits that social media has. I mean, our kids are tech savvy. They're able to connect, and their skills that they're learning engaging with social media, and the world is moving in that place. So it's not just
we're all more informed. Yeah.
And it gives them the platform to express themselves and express their voices and for movements to take off. And absolutely, and that's the incredible part about it. But I think what teens struggle with is finding the balance and finding that line between what it means to express myself and use my voice and what it means to express hate speech or slander or virtually public shame somebody, where those lines are very blurred. And as they're growing and evolving in this adolescent phase, I don't think there's enough education and awareness around what those lines look like and what is appropriate and what is not. Social media, it's almost like anything goes.
I feel like we're all a big like social psychological experiment because we're the first generation living our lives online.
Absolutely.
There is no precursor. There's no case study to prepare us for this mentally. And we're going to just have to learn from our mistakes as we go. But for the children, I worry about them because they're dealing with so many new emotions as it is. And like you said, there's hate speech and bullying. And what's the difference between a hateful initiative and a positive movement? I think that line isn't clear for society as a whole right now in the digital landscape, but especially for our youth, where they want to just be seen and heard. They want to join a tribe. They want to, where must I belong? What will get me more likes and attention? Where is their approval? Because of course, at that age, your identity is based on people's support and approval.
Yeah. And like you say, it's just trial and error. So unfortunately, the error is, it's damaging when they're trialing things out and they're making mistakes. Those mistakes have real consequences. And that's where cyberbullying comes into play. You know, they're navigating relationships, they're navigating interaction. And in the virtual world, when they're navigating something and it doesn't go right, the effects of that can be very harmful and damaging to the person on the other side.
Yeah. Shame, I've seen a lot of bullying, and even just in my communities online recently. And I just feel like everyone's in a really sensitive, fragile time. And like you say, for people that are dealing with something maybe from a very unstable point of view, this gives them a platform to elevate a voice, but they're protected because they're behind a screen. And it can cause so much damage in the victims' lives. So I think, yeah, I'm very interested in those conversations where we look at social media and the impact it has on society, but also for our younger generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just at a very basic level, it's just less FaceTime. You know, those interactions and relationships that they're building on a different platform in a different world. And so I worry about the FaceTime that they do spend with each other, that when they're at school and they're seeing each other face to face, what those communications look like, how they're able to form or foster those relationships healthy, in a healthy manner, because most of it, or when like 70% of it is done online and the 30% of it is done in face to face, what the nature of those relationships really look like. Are they trusting? Are they healthy? And that is my concern around how much time is spent on or built relationship that's built on screen or through the screen.
Yeah. And that's why I just really wanted to chat to you today, because you're dealing with an unprecedented time with the most vulnerable part of our society, and it's our students. And it's like, we're talking about the social media and we're talking about how it takes away that human connection of face-to-face interaction and seeing the whole picture and being able to read the nonverbal cues and read between the lines. And then when they're not on their phones, either learning because of a pandemic or engaging with their community because of the time we're in, they go to school and their friends and their teachers are all, their faces are covered.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but I just have this intuitive feeling of like, I'm really worried about our children's mental health and what this is going to do.
Absolutely. I think during this time, and I speak of empathy and compassion. And empathy and compassion is something that is taught and learned through action, not necessarily through seeing and reading. A lot of social media is done through reading and seeing, and empathy and compassion. So children who need to feel supported and who feel that they need to reach out, I think there's less empathy and compassion for them to reach out to. When we're even face to face, but now, as you mentioned, like we have masks on our faces, we're not able to read each other's body language, we're not able to touch, we're not able to hug. You know, I think just culturally, South Africans are very affectionate people, and we show a lot of care and compassion through hugging and supporting, and even like you say, just a teacher touching somebody's hand or touching their arm.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lack of support around the host of emotions that they're experiencing during this time, even on a face-to-face level.
Shame. And that's why it goes, you know, just to swing back to what we were saying before, if you want to change the world, love your family. Like, there's never been a more important time to point out the importance of a parent's connection and special relationship with their child. Because they're going to into the outside world and everyone else is wearing masks.
Yeah.
So that's just the responsibility. That's the approach I've taken with my family is like, okay, I need to just be aware of what they might be experiencing. I know what it might be because I'm experiencing that fear myself. So when my kids come home, like we cuddle, we hold hands, we talk, I look them in the eye, I kiss them on the cheek. I just smother them with human emotion and connection so that they feel grounded and connected and they can open up and they can share. And then we can at least, you know, take that positive approach. Like, I'm sitting here complaining about my fear, but obviously when I'm in the room with my child, I'm like, yes, I know everyone's wearing masks, but we have to look at it from the information we have. We're so blessed that we live in the age where we can respond this way, that we can prevent a devastating pandemic across the globe. We just have to be careful about germs, and at least we get to look like ninjas.
Absolutely. Because as a parent, you set the tone. And, you know, it's what you're explaining, because I always say to parents, when you are the best kind of care that you can give your child is making sure that you are conscious and aware of when they have character changes or body emotional changes. Look out for those things. Something is going on when your child is not the same, when they're different to who you know them to be. But the truth is that in this time and during this pandemic, everybody is having character changes. Everybody is having different kinds of emotional responses that make them look different to what they usually are. And so it's so important during this time to make sure that you're spending that time with your kids, spending that time connecting, making them feel like you are holding them in this space. And as adults in the room, as you mentioned, we need to make sure that we are getting that from another source where we are strong within ourselves, and we are making sure that we are practicing self-care so that we're able to hold spaces for our children.
Absolutely. We must fill our cups. And same for our teachers and all of the other people that provide a space for our children. So I wanted to ask you, how can our audience find you and connect with you? What's going to happen to your podcast? I know it was a lockdown project. Is it going to carry on? Do your students listen?
Yeah, so I didn't publicly sort of advertise my podcast in our school space, but one of my students seemed to have came across my podcast online and alluded to the fact in class that he had listened to my podcast. And so I thought I'd use the opportunity to sort of speak to them about it. And so I guess a handful of students know about it, but it definitely will continue. I'm definitely continuing to record. I'm just struggling a little bit with more time management.
Yes.
But it's definitely a project that I want to continue because there's never a limit for me for how many stories that I'd like for people to share and tell. I think people's stories are so powerful and such gifts to us. And so I will definitely continue to record. My podcast is called Something to Say on Instagram. It's Something to Say Podcast. You can find me. I have a personal account. I'm Simone Johnston on Instagram as well. That's the social media platform that I'm most active on.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. It was an honor to chat with you today. I have learned so much, and I'm actually going to do a bit more research myself afterwards as well. It was really enlightening. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much for inviting me to chat about this. I'm incredibly passionate about these topics. And also thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing your personal experiences, because I think it's so important that we know that we can relate to each other on so many levels. And that's why these podcasts are so important for us to get that kind of connection and spread love and light through what we're doing. So thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Simone. Have a great day. We'll chat with you soon.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Honest Hour podcast. I hope this recording inspired you to live in your honest truth. And I encourage you, if you enjoyed the episode, to subscribe and to rate the podcast. If you would like to connect with me online, I would love to hear from you. I'm on Instagram at The Honest Hour Podcast, and my website is christinamazarek.co.za. Thank you and have a beautiful day.